Chuck, why this apparent deception? Why this demonic deception? What's their mission? What's their goal? What do they want?
Well, that's one of the things that the whole name Satan means is our accuser. And the whole thing has to do with the whole cosmic warfare in which his agenda, Satan's agenda. First of all, Satan, there's two mistakes you can make about him. One is to assume he doesn't exist.
Right.
And the other is to get so terrified that you don't realize the resources we have against him. But the point is, anyone that doesn't believe he's real, all they have to do is try opposing him for a while. But clearly, his agenda is to thwart the plan of God. And that begs them the question to really understand what God's plan is. But that plan, of course, is all centered around the person of the one that we call Jesus Christ, or Jesus the Messiah, Yeshua HaMashiach. And but his agenda is one of deceit. And that started back in Genesis 3, where he deceived Eve on that very issue. And if you study his methods all the way through Genesis 1 to Revelation 22, you discover that his primary agenda is one of deception. And that's why, as we discover that these UFO things have an agenda of deception, that speaks volumes to someone that is biblically literate, if you will. And so, but that's the agenda. And to understand that agenda, it begs a different question. You really need to understand what God's plan is. And God's plan is all centered around a person. You know, as you study the Bible, you got 66 books penned by 40 guys and so forth. That is an integrated message. But as you study that integrated message, you discover that every page, every detail, always points to a particular person,
mm-hmm.
the person right. of the Creator himself, who chose to enter his creation and perform a mission on our behalf. And everything that happens in the universe is measured by that mission and its success. And so that sounds very strange at first until one really gets into it, but the point is that lifetime, the lifetime of Christ, being incarnate, becoming a man, and fulfilling a destiny that man on his own could not achieve, and to pay our price, if you will, to make it possible for us to end up eternally having a... See, boy, this gets into a whole other area. The whole idea that you and I are eternal, whether we're saved or not, is a shocking discovery. You see, we know today from Einstein's theory of relativity that time is a physical property.
Right.
We tend
right.
to, yeah. And so time varies with mass, acceleration, or gravity, and so on. Well, the point is, when we think of eternity, we visualize that as God having lots of time, when in fact that's good poetry in terms of our songs and things, but it's bad physics. God is not someone. Is God subject to gravity? Hardly. Is he subject to the constraints of mass or acceleration? Of course not. So God is not, he's not subject to the restrictions of mass. Neither are you or me. You and me, see, I can't see you. If I was standing right across, I could only see the temporary residence you're in. I'm sitting here with a laptop computer, and if you knew everything there is to know about every resistor, every transistor, every part of the hardware, you still couldn't tell me about its behavior, because that hardware is simply an environment in which the software resides. The real behavior of that computer, in every respect, is a result of the software that's in it. Now, software has no mass. Software can travel, we can send it through the airwaves, right?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Okay, so the real you, the real George Nuri, is software, not hardware. You are temporarily resident in a body, yes, but the real you, call it soul, spirit, give it fancy labels if you like,
sure.
but the real you is software, not hardware, which means, by the way, the real you has no mass. The real you is eternal, whether you realize it or not. The challenge is, where will you spend it? And you and I have no capacity to imagine what being separated from God really means. We think of death, which is the separation of the body and the soul. We call that physical death. But we have no grasp of the second death, soul and the spirit. And so that's what, the minute you get into those discussions, you now are dealing with a hyperspace, a space beyond the four dimensions that we are normally conversant with, length, width, height, and time. We know, our particle physicists tell us today, that they now know that we live in 10 dimensions. Four are directly perceptible, but six of them are inferable only by indirect means. And that's the boundary discussions in particle physics today, but it also is exactly what the Bible's been saying all along. Paul, in his letter to the Ephesians in chapter 3, verse 18, lists the four dimensions that we presently acknowledge or experience. But so what I guess what I'm saying is the whole issue that that the Bible deals with is the real reality. You know, there's a very fascinating article in Scientific American in 2005 in the June issue talking about the constancy of constants. One of the frontiers in modern science is they're discovering that the things that we have taken for granted are constants in physics, Planck's constant and other things. They're discovering that those constants are not really constant. There are all kinds of experiments trying to challenge that. It turns out, though, interesting words used in that article, if the constants of science are changing, then that demonstrates that our reality is but a subset of a larger reality. And that's their words, not mine. But I was fascinated by that because that's exactly what the Bible has been trying to get across to us all along, is that what we think of as physical reality is a subset of a larger reality. And the real destiny of all of us has to do with that larger reality. And that's what the Bible spends its energies trying to communicate to us. And there is a warfare going on in that hyperspace, if you will. And hyperspace is just a name for something with more than three or four dimensions, obviously. But the point is, there's a warfare, and there's combat going on. And that's exactly what we get glimpses of as we explore from Genesis 1 to Revelation 22. And, of course, one of the climactic passages, of course, is the one that you want to introduce in here to get into the book of Revelation, which is the unveiling. And most people don't read the first sentence. It's the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him. Who gave to what? It's the revelation of Jesus Christ, the unveiling of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him. To whom? Jesus Christ. And he, Christ, sent and signified it, rendered it into signs unto his servant John. And so the unveiling of the whole drama is all encapsulated in that last book. Like most textbooks in college, all the answers are in the back. And that last book is the summary of the whole enchilada. In fact, one of the most interesting studies a person can do is to contrast the details of Genesis, the first book, with the details of Revelation at the end, and you discover that they're all designed to anticipate each other. And so, that's the climax we're moving into.